Hey guys, and welcome to Hunting Land, presented by Great Days Outdoors Magazine. If you'd like to stay up to date on hunting tactics, land management, land values, and land market dynamics, this is the podcast for you. This week's show is brought to you by NCX. As a landowner, the more income I can generate from my land, the better I can take care of it. That's why I trust NCX. They've helped over 20,000 landowners across America earn more than $20 million through programs like carbon credits, wildlife habitat enhancement, solar energy development, sustainable timber management, and more. Want to see what your land could be earning? Visit ncx.com and discover the funding opportunities available to you. And as a Great Days Outdoors listener, you get your first month of NCX membership free. Just use the code GREAT at checkout and unlock the potential of your land today. Again, that's the code GREAT at ncx.com. Air Medcare. Did you know every 40 seconds someone has a heart attack or stroke? In that moment, every second counts and every critical decision matters. Air Medcare Network's air ambulance providers can bring life-saving care directly to those in need at a moment's notice. With 320 locations across 38 states, they're the largest air ambulance membership network. Rest assured, they've got you and your entire household covered. Membership is just $99 a year or just $79 for seniors. Visit gdo.deals/airmedcare to enroll. Texas Hunter. Since 1954, Texas Hunter Products has produced the best engineered and finest quality feeders and hunting blinds in the industry. The Texas Hunter brand has become synonymous with quality and durability. By sticking to premium standards, the company delivers tough, long-lasting products that meet the real-life needs of anglers and hunters across America. Their fish feeders, deer feeders, hunting blinds, and outdoor accessories are among the highest rated in the industry. You can trust that your purchase from Texas Hunter Products will meet your needs for generations to come. To learn more, visit TexasHunter.com.
Hey guys, and welcome back to another episode of Hunting Land. I am your host, Butch Theory, and I'm joined today with Joe Baia as my co-host. How are we doing today, Joe?
Doing good, man. Getting ready to go enjoy this cold front that's moving in. A little holiday deer hunting. I imagine by the time folks hear this, it'll be post-holiday. So if you're hearing this now, I'm sure I've already killed a big buck.
I hope so. That's right.
Pat myself on the back.
Yeah, the weather's looking right, man. All of our food plots are looking right. Thank goodness we got a little rain finally. Got some germination, a lot of deer moving around. Today we're going to be talking about ryegrass and kind of the variations of it. And you hear that all the time, you know, ryegrass. I mean, if you had a room full of hunters, 50 landowners that, you know, plant their own food plots, and you ask them individually, privately, of course, because nobody wants to, you know, say the wrong thing out loud in front of a bunch of people, but if you asked them all what they were planting or what they had in their food plots, what do you think the biggest answer would be, or the most?
I think the vast majority of them would say some component of that planting would be rye. They'd say rye or ryegrass, you know, maybe.
But there's different kinds, right?
A few of them would know the distinctions between cereal rye and ryegrass.
Annual rye.
I bet it's in the majority of food plots that are planted.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree with that. Are we doing the right thing? Are the majority of hunters planting the right stuff that should be in those food plots?
There's a lot of information out there that's what's right, what's best, what's the newest magic bean. And
it's hard to decipher.
You know, and there is. There's a lot of.
You buy a blend, what's in it? Sure. Sometimes it just says rye.
There's a lot of marketing, too, that gets put into what deer prefer, that kind of thing. And deer will eat a lot of things. Deer do pretty well with all kinds of stuff. I mean, they can make it without a lot of help, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot of deer around before anybody planted a food plot ever.
When I think about, you know, my property, though, I'm always thinking about deer because I do enjoy deer hunting. That's the longest season that I've got, you know, other than wild pigs. And I'm always thinking about deer, but I'm also thinking about wild turkeys. I'm also thinking about the soil health of what's there. You know, and when I'm thinking about those deer, I'm also thinking about, I'm trying to put body weight on. I'd like for them to express their full antler.
Yeah. Get as much horn growth as possible.
I want to make sure that if I'm taking, I mean, for all the energy we put into our food plots.
Energy, money, time. Yeah, it's a lot, man.
I don't want to plant the wrong thing, you know.
No, and no doubt.
To hear that ryegrass is bad was a new one for me. Just Here in the last couple of years is when I first started to hear that, and man, I shudder to think of how many ryegrass seeds I've scattered about the Southeast. You
Yeah, no doubt, man.
know, and I mean, you
And
may not think that's a bad thing. The reality is, we're going to get into the data today. We're
we're
going to
gonna
get into
find
the
out.
research, and we're going to find out why you do not want ryegrass in your food plot. And to help us sort out this ryegrass problem today, we are talking with, I was thinking about this before the show and I couldn't decide how I wanted to introduce our next guest. I was thinking maybe the second smartest man to hail from Theodore, Alabama, or maybe the second best turkey hunter to come from Theodore, Alabama. I'm not sure, but we're talking with Dr. Will Goolsbee from Auburn University. War Eagle.
War Eagle.
You and I both come from the same place, and Butch is now living there.
Yeah, okay.
So we've got the second smartest and the third smartest guy from Theodore, Alabama on here today. That's good.
Well, I mean, I'll take second as high praise, honestly.
That's right.
In any almost category, really.
Well, good to have you on, man. You know, this is a topic that I think a lot of people are going to go, wait a minute, ryegrass is bad now? What's wrong with ryegrass? You
Yeah,
know,
that's
and
how I feel. We've been playing it for years, I feel like.
Right. Yeah. And it's in a lot of mixes, but there's also a lot of mixes that say rye. And you wonder, you know, so I've noticed that a lot. Like, is it cereal rye or is it rye grass? And, you know, does the seed blend manufacturer even know? Because what really brought this show about was last spring, I let my food plots go a little bit longer, hoping to provide a little better habitat for wild turkeys. And as things started to bolt in late April, early May, I'm thinking, boy, this is looking good. Everything's really taking off. All this no-till I've been doing, it must really be helping. And I get up there and I look at this seed head that's formed and I go, wait a minute, this is not cereal rye. And I pull out my little phone app and it says, this is rye grass. And I'm going, I haven't planted any dadgum rye grass. To my knowledge, that hasn't been in my blend, but here it is. So what's up with that, Will?
So all really good questions. Cereal rye is a great food plot planting. It has, and we can, I'm sure we'll go into this more in just a little while, but as far as deer selection, cereal rye is up there with wheat. But it is not to be confused with annual ryegrass or Italian ryegrass. Those are kind of the two major offenders that we see. And the reason that I tend to steer away from intentionally planting it, and I even recommend in many cases that landowners try to eradicate it from their food plots, is well, first of all, I guess backing up, the way it gets established in a lot of these places, like in your situation, maybe the landowner intentionally planted ryegrass because they'd been told that it's easy to grow and attractive to deer. Both of those things are partially true. We can get into that in more detail in a second as well. Or it was unintentionally planted as part of a seed blend that they purchased, like you were saying with the issues with the labeling. Or number three, it's really easy to transfer around on equipment, right? And then we see that with all sorts of invasives down there in y'all's part of the world. Kogan grass is probably one that gets talked
Sprayed
about the most. Yeah,
some of
definitely.
that the other day, unfortunately.
With getting transferred around on equipment. But during fall or winter time, if you compare it, I'm going to assume that most of your listeners and you guys are probably familiar with what wheat looks like as it's coming up out of the ground. Ryegrass is a bright green, much finer grass, and you'll see it kind of volunteering. I mean, if you go out and you drop a disc in the ground anytime from like August, September, October, that time of the year, and things start to turn cold, it's a cool season annual grass, and so it'll naturally start to come up on its own from seed. So even though it's an annual plant, because it is such a prolific reseeder, and Joe, like you said, as evidence of that, if you let a food plot go fallow into the spring and it has ryegrass in it, you'll see those really noticeable seed heads. And to contrast it, I already talked about the size of the leaf blades with them being really fine on annual ryegrass. In addition to that, when it bolts and it sends up that seed head, Annual ryegrass has, the spikelets, where each seed would be on the seed head.
Right.
Those spikelets will have 10 to 20 what we call florets along it, with really conspicuous awns that stick out from it. Whereas a cereal rye will have a much smaller seed head with about half the number of those little spiky things coming off of it. So that's one way that you can tell the difference, and that's how it typically gets established in areas. And once you have it, because it is such a prolific reseeder, it's almost impossible to get rid of without a really concerted effort.
Yeah, well, I want to talk about that later, about selfishly what I need to do this spring and probably for subsequent years, subsequent plantings, to try to knock it back and, give what I want out there in that plot a chance. You mentioned, it's very commonly used because it's really easy to grow, right? Like, I mean, you could just about throw it out in the bed of your truck and that stuff will grow.
No, you can. You can just about. I've done that.
Why is it problematic? I mean, I love that it's easy to grow, but I mean, why should we hate it?
Well, and I'll be in full transparency. I have planted annual ryegrass at points in the past.
I think it's important that you make that distinction right there, because it's not to say like you're an awful person for having planted ryegrass. We've all done it. We didn't know, or it was part of a blend. Like, this is not bashing. This is like, hey, let's get better. Let's progress.
No,
No,
I'm in that camp. I want to learn. I've killed a lot of deer with ryegrass in their mouths, So
That's
it's
right.
attractive too. But, I would like to say, as I became more educated on the topic, that, I started to steer away from it over time. And I think the hardest hitting facts on this, and the reason why I have steered away from it, and we'll just talk about the deer component for a second, and then we can get to the turkey habitat aspect of it later. But from a deer selection perspective, Dr. Craig Harper, who I'm sure y'all are familiar with his work at the University of Tennessee, he did some trials comparing annual ryegrass to different forage plantings for deer up in Tennessee a few years ago. And basically, they took this field and they separated it out into different areas, planted different species in different areas of the field, and then they monitored the deer use of the different forage plantings, both in terms of, they had cameras set up, so they were looking at the actual visitation to each of these plots, and then they also had exclusion cages that deer could, where the deer could not forage in the plots, so that they could measure how much biomass each of these forage plantings was growing compared to how much was consumed outside of the cage. So that allowed them to assess both how intensively the deer used it, and then also the tonnage of forage that they were able, to get out of each of these different plantings. So if you compare ryegrass to the other two main cereal grains that we oftentimes plant for deer, which are wheat, which you've already talked about, and cereal rye, which is the other big one that we've talked about, it does not produce as much forage per acre, and it does not get consumed at the same rate as either of those other two. So specifically, you go from ryegrass, which produces about 5,000 pounds of forage per acre, to wheat that produces about 6,000, and then cereal rye that produces about 7,000 pounds of forage per acre. Okay. So it's already producing less than either of those other two cereal grains. But the selection, the consumption specifically, was really the most telling part of that study for me. So with ryegrass, deer were only consuming 10% of the biomass that was produced, compared to 50% for cereal rye and 65% for winter wheat.
Wow.
What I'm hearing you say is it's less palatable. Like, the
That's right.
animals that we're trying to attract don't want it as much as the neighbors if he's got wheat.
That's right.
And it's going to produce less nutrition because it's just producing less. So, if there's 6,000 pounds of wheat out there and 5,000 pounds of
That's
ryegrass
right.
out there, even if they eat it all, they're getting better nutrition with the wheat. But
That's
all,
right.
but you know, and so you're, like you said, you're talking about deer, but I've also got other goals with my food plots, like soil health, and I'm trying to produce organic matter. It's not going to produce as much organic matter either for those subsequent years. So I mean, it's just not as good if you're already going through the trouble to plant. Why use it when there's better
Yeah.
options?
Well, and that's the other factor too, right? Is if you are going through the trouble and expense associated with planting, having ryegrass sticking around in your food plots is, you know, call it, it's resulting in a net decrease in the cost efficiency of that food plot because of the competition that it presents for the seed that you're paying to plant and put in
Right.
the ground. So like all, you know, your time, your diesel fuel, the cost of the seed, the cost of the soil amendments, all that stuff is, you know, its efficacy is being reduced by this competitor, which again, to reiterate, is not producing as much. And even though it's not producing as much, is consumed at a much lower rate on top of that. And
Right.
I think that the reason that a lot of deer hunters still allow it to persist or even still intentionally plant it in some situations is, let's be honest, in the Southeast, we have a lot of areas that are relatively poor deer habitat, right? Like a, you know, unthinned woods, you know, whether those be pine or hardwoods, there's not a lot of food within a deer's reach. And so if you have a power line right away or something like that, that ha or a little food plot, little opening in the canopy that has some ryegrass coming up in it, you will see deer use that heavily. But again, if it was next to something that was more preferred and more productive, you would see a different story.
Right.
That makes sense.
I think most of the people that listen to this podcast are interested in creating the best environment for wildlife on their property. They're interested in enhancing their soil, their dirt to
Yeah,
leave it
you're
better
already
than they
doing all the
found it.
work. You're already
That's
doing all the
right.
work. You might as well do the best work possible.
That's
Yeah.
right.
And that's just on the deer side of things. Why is this bad for turkeys? And
Yeah.
others, I mean, but me, I
Yeah.
mostly care about the turkeys.
Absolutely. I'm in the same boat with you there, Joe. But yeah, so the problem with ryegrass and when it comes to turkeys is in the spring when it does bolt, as we talked about earlier, it grows up in these really dense, almost pure stands across the food plot. We were talking, I think, before we hit record about your food plot where that happened. And if you've got it growing in a food plot and you get out there around April or May, you know it. You will know that you have ryegrass because it'll be about knee tall. It has these huge seed heads on it. And it's a dog hair thick stand of grass. And the problem with that for turkey poults, well, let me back up for a second. Hens will nest in it. Okay. So a hen will nest in it. I flushed several hens out of ryegrass food plots, including a couple last year. But what concerns me is once those poults hatch out of the egg, they can't move through it. So they can't get to where they need to go. But even if maybe that hen nests right on the edge of it, so they're able to stumble their way out of it and make it to another area where they can, you know, oh, there's a great picture of it. Yeah. Even if they're able to stumble out of that food plot, make it out alive somehow, that area has become unusable space for those poults for at least the first few weeks of life until they get a little bit bigger and stronger. So they're not able to extract any kind of insects or other types of forage out of that area because it's so dense. And the reason that that's a problem is we're seeing more and more evidence emerging that brooding cover where the hen takes her poults to bug, where they also have some security cover from the vegetation so they're not getting picked off by hawks and you know, ground-based predators too. Is so lacking from the landscape that that's probably one of the major bottlenecks for turkey populations. And because the Southeast is so heavily forested and we have so few of these open areas, if I'm managing for turkeys, I want to make sure that all the open acreage that I have is managed as effectively as it can be for turkeys and that it represents, you know, space that they can use effectively. And ryegrass doesn't provide that.
So, if I'm understanding you correctly, the sky isn't falling necessarily on my place because I've got a ryegrass problem, because I'm also keeping my pine plantations thinned. I'm burning them on a regular basis.
Sure.
I've got a good hardwood component there that's
Yeah,
providing.
giving them plenty of other
They've
options.
got other places to go
Sure.
where I am. So maybe it's not such a big deal. I don't have to
Not
freak
as
out and lose
critical.
sleep.
Yeah.
But if you're dealing with most of the coastal plain, at least,
Yeah.
you're talking about very unmanaged, for the most part, pine plantations
Yeah.
where that open space is maybe the only open space those turkeys have around. And
Right.
so if it's dense, with ryegrass,
Yeah.
it's they're already hurting, and this is just another
Absolutely.
bad
And
thing.
let's think about it this way too. I mean, the vast majority of us that hunt in the South, we hunt on timber leases, right?
Right.
And those timber leases are growing pine trees because that's what the company's, their business model is set up around. So they're not going to have a lot of openings, and they're probably not, implementing a lot of fire. So if you're lucky enough to have a few food plots on your lease, that's essentially some of your only open ground. And if that open ground is dominated by ryegrass, it's not effective for broods to use, during that critical period or after they emerge from the nest.
You already mentioned how ryegrass can negatively impact the overall diversity of the food plot. So if I'm
Yeah.
planting a blend, I've got 10 different things out there. I've got grains, grasses, legumes, and brassicas, and all these other goodies that I'm planting, and I'm trying to improve soil health, and I'm trying to feed deer, feed turkeys, do all these things. Ryegrass just beats them all, doesn't it? I mean,
It
it's
does.
like it
Yeah.
doesn't produce as much forage. It's not as palatable. But is it just more vigorous? Is that what makes it so? I mean, it's just
Yeah.
outcompeting everything. It's like a weed.
Yeah. Yeah. It's invasive, right? I mean, that's like the definition of invasive. So, yeah, it's cutting back on the production of your other crops, and then it's excluding animals from the area. And the other thing too is, we've been talking about what happens in spring mostly from a turkey perspective, but also keep in mind, if you plant like a classic, one of my favorite blends is like a wheat crimson clover, and then maybe I'll even mix in a little bit of arrowleaf clover in there too, and go with some kind of blend like that. I can still get deer use of those crops into the spring if I don't have ryegrass choking them out. Because a lot of people don't know this, but deer will eat wheat seed heads if you allow them to seed out, and they're actually fairly nutritious.
I was really excited last year because I keep game cameras on all my food plots, cell cameras on all my food plots, just to watch the growth and see how things are going. And I'd been turkey hunting and everything looked pretty good. And then, things started warming up and I saw everything coming up and I was like, finally, all this effort I've been putting into no-till is paying off. Look at that food plot. Look how it's coming up. It's lush. And then I get up there and I'm like, oh man, here we go. Like another curveball thrown. And so now I'm looking at it going, all right, what am I going to do? So this year, my plan is to get ahead, right? Like I know it's coming. I know it's going to come back. All that, that picture I just showed you. I mean, all these seed heads were viable. They all made it down to the dirt. They're still there. They're just waiting for this spring. So I've got a problem on my hands. Luckily, it's not in every field, which is interesting. I've got three big food plots on my property, all about, 3.5, 4 acres a piece. And it's only in the center field. Like it isn't in the north, it's not to the south. And what's interesting about that is I have never knowingly planted it, but this field was established before I bought the property. So it's been getting planted for years and years and years. Those other two fields I created from pine plantations, destumped and all that. And so
Well, there's
clearly
your
this is in the
explanation,
seed bank before I even bought it. And that's what I don't quite understand about it is that I've never tilled this soil at all. I've never dissed. I have burned it, but apparently there's just enough in the seed bank there that
She's gonna
it was
keep coming
able to
up.
outcompete. So
That's right. I've got a field that I'm managing right now just down the road. I actually went and looked at it this morning on the way into the office, and I need to spray the ryegrass in it. And it's a field that I'm pretty much just maintaining as kind of like a native prairie. I mostly want it to provide brooding cover for turkeys during the summertime. So I just want a mix of, native grasses and wildflowers out there, really more native wildflowers than even grasses, because those flowers are so attractive to the bugs that they eat. And they're also a lot of the flower species, the forbs, are really good seed producers as well. That's all I did with that one is I burn it last fall with my class as kind of a demonstration for them to get their hands on some fire, some prescribed fire. And it's got a solid blanket of just that really fine, bright green grass coming up in it right now. It's ryegrass. So yeah, you don't have to necessarily disturb the soil at any time. There's an opportunity, if there's open space where it's free to grow, it's going to take advantage of it. And part of that is here in the deep south, we don't have a lot of cool season plants. And ryegrass is specifically, evolved to be a cool season grass. And so it grows during a time of the year where a lot of our other stuff is dormant and allows it to take advantage of that.
So you mentioned spraying there. What does Joe do? I mean, is it something that he's going to have to battle every single year, or is there a, a cure all, or what does he do?
You have to be aggressive with it for sure. The best time of the year to spray it is going to be in fall. And when I say fall, use that loosely, because we are, we're here recording this right now. And I don't know if you want me to say this because you're going to launch the podcast episode
No,
later
it's
or
fine.
not.
Yeah,
But
it's December as we're recording this.
yeah,
Yeah.
so it's December. I'm going to spray it now. I'm going to go ahead and spray it because it, especially like if we get a warm spell of weather like we are right now. I mean, it's, it was 70 something degrees here in Auburn yesterday. And it'll be susceptible to herbicide application. So I'll go ahead and spray it now. You can also get some control in spring. And if you want to get control of it quick, fast, in a hurry, you can do both fall applications and spring applications. But basically, and the guiding principle on controlling any grass species is you want to target them with an herbicide when they're young and actively growing. So for a cool season grass, that's going to be the prime time is going to be fall. And then of course in the middle of winter, they even though they're a cool season grass, they'll even slow down their growth and then they'll start to grow again more vigorously in the spring. But keep in mind that in the spring, they're starting to enter their reproductive phase and they'll bolt quickly and send up those seed heads. And once that's happened, not only do you already have the seed that's been produced, which is going to just create a new crop next year, but also, once they've moved on into that reproductive phase, they're not as susceptible to the herbicide any longer. So, ideally, what I would do is if I had an area that was dominated by ryegrass in the fall, I would mow it, or you could even just go ahead and spray it with just a broad spectrum cheap herbicide like glyphosate, generic Roundup, and allow that to brown out. If you've mowed it, allow that thatch to dry out that's on the ground. If you've sprayed it, give it a couple of weeks to brown it out, and then I'll burn it off. And then a lot of times, by October, November, whenever you're able to do this, you see that blanket of that real fine-bladed grass start to come up, and that's when I'll hit it with herbicide. You want to hit it before it's about 5 or 6 inches tall, and that's when it's going to be most susceptible. And the herbicide that I prefer to use for annual ryegrass is clethodim. And the reason I like clethodim, and that's the generic name, so you can buy it under a di bunch of different product labels. You can get a generic version that would be relatively inexpensive compared to the brand name version. But regardless, it's a grass selective herbicide that is not going to affect your broadleafs. So if you've got some clover planted in the plot, that clover should be fine. And it'll also allow any of your native forbs, those wildflowers that I was talking about earlier that are important for insect attraction and seed production for turkeys and other birds, to continue to grow. So I prefer clethodim.
All right, guys, let's take a quick break. Check out a few of this week's great sponsors.
Simple Pets. From Pradco Outdoor Brands, makers of the Texas Hunter line of game and fish feeders, comes the latest innovation to your pet care. Meet the Blazer Automatic Dog Feeder. Whether you're at home or away, it serves up perfectly portioned meals to your loyal companion. There's no need for a power outlet. It runs just like your deer or fish feeder with a rechargeable battery. And with a 40-pound capacity and a sturdy stainless steel bowl, it's made for dogs of all sizes, indoors or out. Ready to make life easier for both you and your dog? Visit TexasHunter.com and check out the Blazer Automatic Dog Feeder. Your dog will love it. Farm Credit of Northwest Florida. Do you dream of living the country lifestyle? Farm Credit of Northwest Florida can make it happen. As a member-owned financial cooperative, they provide rural-friendly loan products for recreational property, agriculture, timber, home construction, improvements, and refinances. Their knowledgeable team is passionate about helping you achieve your dream to live, work, or play in the country. Farm Credit of Northwest Florida, more than a lender, they're your trusted partner. Visit them at gorural.net. 157 Outfitters operates out of southeastern Wyoming, utilizing 100% private leases. They offer hunts for waterfowl, pronghorn, white-tailed deer, mule deer, turkey, and elk. Their area is world-renowned as possibly the most consistent quality waterfowl hunting in the United States. For their deer, antelope, and turkey hunts, they are unique in the ability that they can draw a license for you and get you hunting within 1 year. Hunts are operated out of two lodges on the banks of the North Platte River. Firearms, ammo, and a private chef can all be arranged prior to your arrival. Reserve your spot today at 157outfitters.com. You mentioned the clethodim, and you're able to basically save those clovers. If you're dealing with this problem, you know, I'm just kind of going in back. Let's say we had done this podcast back in July, right? We knew this was coming for the guys planting fall food plots. My thought there would be like, well, don't waste your money planting wheat and cereal rye and, you know, these other things that clethodim's going to get. Like, maybe just focus on clovers. And or if you're doing it in the spring, you might say, I mean, I know the benefits of planting a diverse blend. However, do you think you'd be better off in some cases to like, all right, this summer, let's go full Roundup Ready soybeans, you know, and then just be able to keep herbicide on that ryegrass and still be providing some forage?
Yeah, 100%. I do that all the time. So if I, you know, personally and with landowners that I work with, you know, if they've got a big enough field to support a Roundup Ready crop, and, you know, when you're talking about Roundup Ready, you're talking about a larger landowner that has maybe a little bit higher budget than the average person, but I'll go with that. You know, if they've got a general weed problem that includes broadleaf and grass species, I'll go with like a Roundup Ready soybean or something like that so that I can just spray it, you know, just spray right over the top of it for several years until I get that problem under control. A more budget-friendly solution is like you suggest, and it's not just with ryegrass, it's with any problematic weeds. If I have a bunch of invasive, you know, non-native warm season grass, you know, like Bermuda or Bahia or something like that, then I will just plant broadleaf in that plot until I am able to control that grass. Where conversely, if I have a broadleaf weed problem, I'll just plant cereal grains in that food plot for a while,
right?
Or I'll plant corn in there for a while. And so I can apply like a 2,4-D, which is selective against broadleaf weeds, until I get that problem under control. And then my options open back up for what I can plant going forward from there. But with ryegrass, what you're typically going to find is even if you take that optimal approach of spraying during the fall, it's going to take 3, maybe even 4 years of application before you're able to exhaust that seed source, that seed bank.
Damn.
So it's like you're chipping away at it over time because it's just such a prolific seed producer that essentially what you're trying to do is allow it to grow up, kill it in its vegetative state, allow the next round of seeds to come up, kill that in its vegetative state until there's just no more seeds left in the soil.
Yeah,
and that's another reason why you really don't want to ever intentionally plant it, because maybe it sounds good to you right now, but 5 years down the road, you know, all of us change our minds and we change our objectives on a property over time, but you're still dealing with that legacy that's going to be expensive and time consuming to eradicate.
Well, and also just thinking about it from an ecosystem perspective, right? We've been talking about it's not as good of a forage for deer as other things. It's it's very bad for turkey poults. Well, you know, what about the fact that I'm going to have to spray this field for 4 years? Where you know, the whole reason I've been going towards no-till,
get away
from having to spray. But now this is going to affect my no-till plantings to the point where I'm going to have to spray.
Right,
and that just means that's that much more herbicide I'm going to have to put on the landscape, which has downrange, you know, soil health impacts and so on and so forth. And but you know, the good news is there is a way around it. But it sounds like I'm going to have to be really diligent. Folks are going to have to be really diligent and also just think through too, because like when you said that about like go spray right now, I'm going, well, it's the middle of deer season. I don't want to go spray my food plot. You know,
sure.
But if I had known what you just said this fall, then I could have said, I'm going to stick with clover in this field. Like, that's all I'm going to do this year in this field is clover.
Yeah, just go with like some crimson clover or something like that.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, that would be better than nuking it down to nothing.
Yeah, right.
So for folks that are in the struggle of, it's hard to get anything to grow at my place, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they're hunting piney woods, sandy soils, you know, acidic soils, shady. They're planting log landings and you know, the widest logging roads they can find and things like this. Like that ryegrass is really attractive because it grows so easy.
Yeah.
What's the alternatives for folks that want to press the easy button?
This one, I'm going to go out on a limb on this one. I don't know that anybody will actually attempt it. But what I personally would do, if I were in that situation where it was small acreage and I can't afford soil amendments and I know that I've got really poor acidic soils, I'm going to manage that those areas for native vegetation. Because you will get better growth. I mean, the word native implies that they're adapted to that condition, right? That's where they're from. And there are a lot of these forbs that we can, like ragweed is kind of the poster child. It can have the same protein content as like as many of the clover species that we plant, and it's out there freely available to you in the seed bank. So all you have to do is time your management and your disturbance in such a way that you cultivate those species and you don't even have to necessarily plant anything. And you can have an area that's very attractive to deer during the summer and on through early fall. Probably not going to be as attractive during the winter as ryegrass is because, like I said, we don't have a lot of native cool season plants. But you could still probably, you know, throw a little weed out and you're probably not going to get the most vigorous growth, but you can get some growth out of it. But yeah, if I'm in a situation where I just can't amend the soil, the production from a agronomic species that we could plant is probably going to be so low anyway that I would just favor those native plants instead and allow it to grow up into sort of a fallow food plot.
Favoring those native plants, is that just a function of mowing and disturbing in some way, whether it be burning it down with a herbicide, mowing
Yeah.
it, what a strip disc, and like, what do you recommend to somebody? Let's just use a common example. I've got a log landing. Lots of people will take a log landing and throw out the cheapest seed they can find, so
Yeah.
they hope they can come back and shoot a deer over it.
Right.
What would you do functionally in that spot?
Would you fertilize it or anything like that?
Yeah, it depends on what starts coming up. I mean, the fertilization, what it would benefit from you. Fertilizing native plants will change their biomass production. They'll produce a lot more young growing tips, right? So the DNA of the plant doesn't change in response to fertilization. So the leaves that are the same age on a plant that's unfertilized are going to have relatively the same nutrient content. But what's different is when you fertilize, they're growing a lot more actively. They're producing a lot more young growth. And so you will have more mass of that high quality, high preference forage available to it. So that would be an option. But to start stimulating that favorable plant community, typically what I'm going to do is I'm going to go out and I'm going to disturb the soil with a disc or something like that once we've had a good hard frost. And the reason for that is that most of the native forbs that we want to stimulate the growth of are going to respond to disking during that time of the year after we've had a frost. A lot of the agricultural pests and a lot of our invasive species are stimulated by soil disturbance during the growing season. So we want to avoid that. So we could start with that soil disturbance sometime around November, December, depending on where we are in the state. You know, you could get away with a little bit earlier in November if you're further up in North Alabama, and you could get away with going all the way into December in the southern part of the state. And that's going to get you headed in the right direction by stimulating growth of a lot of the preferred native species. And then all I'm going to do going forward from that over time is I'm just going to use a spot spray application of herbicide. And it requires learning some of the plants and understanding which ones are highly selected for by deer and which ones are not. And then you just go out there and you spray the less preferred plants, and you just basically are cultivating what you want to grow and what you don't want to grow. So, for instance, the native grasses aren't going to make a lot of contribution to deer forage. You know, deer don't really eat native warm season grasses, so you could spray some of those. You might want to keep a few of them here and there for some turkey cover, some turkey nesting. You know, you will want to spray out any of the tree saplings, whether you've got pine trees or little sweet gums and things like that coming up out there. And you just really start to shape it and cultivate it over time.
And one of the reasons that, you know, a lot of people, for whatever reason it may be, they want a quick food plot, you know,
Yeah.
if whether you're, I mean, it's been several years where we, you know, hadn't planted until the end of November.
Well, this year's a good example. We had that, I mean,
Yeah.
it was a
And
drought.
last
You
year.
just, yeah, I mean, you if you planted around those hurricanes, you were good, but then there was that long gap and a lot of
Yeah.
folks were didn't get it in and
Yeah.
you're planting late. You need something that's going to produce and produce tonnage quickly, like you said.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is there an alternative that grows at a, you know, a like the same rate or close to it that's going to be more beneficial?
I've never seen comparisons of growth rate between ryegrass and other species, but I do know I've successfully planted wheat in December in Alabama and had it come up. First time that I did it, it was at a landowner's recommendation. It was well before I, got into this job. I was still kind of just, hunting and managing land by the seat of my pants at that point in time. And I thought he was crazy asking me to plant wheat in December, but it came right up. But like I said, I'm not sure if ryegrass produces faster than wheat does in that situation or not. I've never seen any data on that.
Yeah, it's
I
like a good
think
alternative.
a good a cereal rye too would also do well because it grows so well at those colder temps that it may not grow as fast. I don't know, it may grow as fast, but where other plants start to slow down, it doesn't. So I feel like you could just go to a cereal rye as opposed to a rye grass. And I feel like that's where a lot of that confusion comes from
No
too.
doubt.
You
Yeah,
hear
for
one guy
sure.
saying cereal rye is great, and the other guy, and for the average dude who's, working his job and raising his family and deer hunting something fun that he does that's fun on the weekends, like he's not digging that deep into it. I know I'm certainly in that camp in a lot of respects. And, I feel like I've heard it over and over again, like, oh, that's good enough. Those deer will come in there and eat on that. And you said that at the beginning, like, absolutely they will. They'll come in there and eat it if it's the best thing around.
That's right.
But
That's right.
if your neighbor's doing everything right, and that can be the difference between who's attracting the deer.
And I have a hard time with this too, because I mean, I can empathize with those guys that don't have a lot of acreage to plant, don't have a lot of time and money to do it, because it can be, you throw it on the ground in an open spot and it's gonna bring in deer. And the one place I saw you sent me a list of questions ahead of time that you're thinking the conversation would steer towards. And one of those was, I think, something about would there ever be a situation where I would plant it? And I have seen some kind of out of the way little food plots that people are using as kind of like stopover or like intercept food plots on the way to larger that, they can intercept a buck on the way to a larger,
A staging
five.
plot, or some people call them a hidey hole.
Exactly. You know exactly what I'm talking about. So you're trying to intercept them on the way to a larger field that they're not going to come out in till it's dark. Doesn't give me a ton of heartburn to think about using in that situation. But again, one thing to keep in mind is this stuff is really easy to pick up on equipment. So, if you're going to be cultivating that little plot at all, just understand that it carries the risk of potentially serving as a source to invasion in your other fields.
Yeah, be pretty easy to transfer around.
So much easier than you think to transfer. Like in my common sense meter goes off. I'm like, are you really gonna transmit that many seeds just by, mowing it and then going somewhere else? Like it just seems like that would be such like what did I drop? Like 10 seeds or something. Like that's where my head goes. I was on a property down here in Florida not too long ago, and I was way back in the interior of this property, way back in the woods, going to check out this little food plot about like you're describing. It was probably a quarter acre max, just a little bow plot. And I was just getting pictures, and I got there, and the thing was just loaded with Kogan grass. And it's just not around anything, and I'm thinking, how in the world Kogan grass get back here? And I hadn't seen it on the whole property. And as I was leaving that day out on the right of way on the highway, I turn out and the whole entire side of the road is Kogan grass. And I'm thinking, landowner bush hogged. He's out here bush hogging the road, making things look good. And then he goes back and bush hogs his little bow plot back in the way back. And just that was all it took. And there it is, way back in there. And sounds like ryegrass is similar in that respect.
Absolutely. And I tend to be fairly diligent about cleaning my equipment, especially like if we're doing research on a landowner's property, we're always really careful about cleaning as much as we can before we, transport to another place, because we don't want to cross pollinate things that people don't want. But anyone that's d spent much time on a tractor, mowing, bush hogging, or disking, you can go out there and you can spray it down with a water hose or, blow it off with a blower or something like that. But like underneath that bush hog where you just have all those areas, those crevices where things accumulate and build up, and it really, as productive as this plant is in terms of seed production, it does not take much, like you said, Joe, to really start a strong population somewhere else.
All right, folks, we're going to be right back. Y'all take a minute and check out some of our sponsors. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply offer numerous items to help get your project done right the first time. They carry a variety of different panel profiles and your choice of colors and gauges with all the matching trim and accessories. They also offer a full line of hardware items and post-frame building design. Their friendly and knowledgeable sales representatives are always willing to help answer any questions or concerns you may have. Contact them with any questions or to get a free estimate today. Baker Metalworks and Dixie Supply, your metal roofing headquarters. Southern Seed and Feed. Do you want to provide better nutrients to your deer? If so, try Southern Buck Food Plot Blends. Your deer will love it. At Southern Seed and Feed, they specialize in making textured feed for horses, cattle, sheep, goats, hogs, chickens, small animals, and wildlife. Their products are proven irresistible, scientifically formulated to promote excellent herd health and hunter satisfaction. They supply products to various distributors throughout the South. So visit their website at southernseedfeed.com or call 662-726-2638 to find the dealer nearest you. Bucks Island Marine. At BucksIsland.com, you can check out the full list of inventory from new and used bass, pontoon, and bow rider style boats, new and used motors, as well as kayaks. They love trade-ins, which provides a steady stream of used boats, and they can rig your boat at their 18-bay service department or ship your new motor anywhere in the United States. They provide boat service on all kinds of boats, even if they weren't purchased from Bucks. They have factory-trained and certified technicians, so visit them at 4500 Highway 77 in Southside, Alabama, or give them a call at 256-442-2588. Will, in talking about, you know, ryegrass, the ryegrass problem that I think a lot of people face in their food plots, you know, I hesitate to even bring stuff like this up a lot of times because it seems like, especially when it comes to food plots, it's like, man, can't win. First, I was... First, you know, tillage is bad, you know, and so I thought I was doing a good thing by planting a food plot, and now I got a no-till, you know, and then, well, yeah, I mean, no-till's good, but you really need to get away from the herbicides. And it's like, okay, all right, I'll stop. I'll use a crimper now. And so, and you know, it seems like it keeps going and going and going and going. And I've started to hear people say things like, man, I ain't fooling with all that anymore. I'm just going to put a feeder up.
Yeah.
And I personally, for lots of different reasons, don't feed on my property at all.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So whether it's supplemental or baiting, I don't do it. I don't look down my nose at people that do because I think it's subjective as to whether or not, you know, you feel that is challenging enough and you feel like you've accomplished something if you kill one over bait. Like that's a personal thing.
Yeah. And I mean, there's also a whole spectrum of the ways people do it too.
Sure.
You know?
Sure. Yeah. And I'm not going to, I mean, I've hunted over bait before, mm-hmm. you know, it's not like I'm saying I'm better than somebody who does.
Right.
I don't bait because I've done it and I don't enjoy doing it. Like I don't like driving. I don't like putting the pressure on the property. I just don't enjoy really any aspect of it. And I really enjoy getting together with my brother and planting food plots in the late summer, early fall. And I would just rather do it one time than do it throughout the season. But I worry about, like, you know, people feeling overwhelmed and just going, man, I'm just tired of, like, it seems like no matter what I do, it's wrong. And I'm just going to start baiting. There's a lot of, you know, again, there's a subjective side to it. Then there's a scientific side to it.
Sure.
Why would you tell somebody don't bait, plant a food plot?
Well, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. You know, one of the things that comes to mind for me is if they're choosing to implement that practice because they think it's more economical or easier, I would encourage them to sit down and do some back of the envelope math on that and actually figure out what they're paying to pour that feed out versus and include, you know, any trips that you make out to the property that
and the
you're
feeder,
not hunting.
Feeder cost.
Yeah. Think about the cost of your feeder. Think about the cost of your batteries. Think about all the fuel and your time of filling feeders when you're not hunting. And then, you know, think about also, of course, the money that you spend on the corn itself. And I would guess that in many cases, it would probably be cheaper for folks if they have a plantable acreage to actually amend that soil properly and plant it in a good mix that will provide, nutrition for deer and turkeys and good cover for turkeys during the spring and early summer versus, just using corn to attract deer. And the corn is not going to have that benefit of providing that structure for turkeys, because a lot of deer hunters are turkey hunters too, But the thing that gives me the most pause about corn feeding, especially the aflatoxin, is definitely a risk. That's something that I think that we all need to be aware of. But it doesn't, the aflatoxin exposure risk does not concern me as much as the unknowns about how it's influencing the predator community. And specifically, when you look at some of the survey work that's been done that starts to give us some insight on just how much corn is being put out in states where it's legal to bait deer, I mean, it is. It, I mean, for lack of a better term, it's an ungodly amount of supplemental feed that is going into species other than deer and turkeys, and many of them that are predators of deer and turkeys. And so I think that if we're not actually increasing the survival and reproduction of predators, we're at the very least concentrating them around an area that our preferred game species that we're managing for are regularly visiting, so they're able to cue on that and scent trail them, back to where they came from, or just ambush them at the feed site. I mean, how many photos have you seen, have had people send you of coyotes attacking a deer or a turkey or something like that with a feeder in the frame? It happens all the time. And so I have some serious concerns, especially during a time period where we know, specifically with turkeys, we've got low nest success, we've got low brood survival, and we've got low adult survival in several areas, particularly adult hens, which are the reproductive engine of that population. I don't want to do anything to give predators any more of an advantage than they already have. And they already have the upper hand in many regards. And part of that is because habitat composition. And this is like we could do a whole nother episode or even a series of episodes on this, but habitat composition is shifting in a way that it favors the predator over the prey. So I don't want to pour any more gas on that fire than we already have. And that's the way I think about it.
I feel like I've maybe seen you or talked to you at some point, and you told me about some research that they were actually basically able to determine the percentage of feed that went to non-game species over game species. Do you remember
Yeah,
a
there's
quick
some data.
breakdown of that?
Yeah, there was a study from Oklahoma State. I don't remember the exact statistics, but there more than half of the corn in that particular study, I'm saying half being conservative, I think it was way more than half, actually went to raccoons.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so
Yeah,
every
that's
time you pick up
a lot of
that
your
50
corn
pound
not
bag,
going to deer.
yeah,
Yeah,
you just know that
absolutely.
25 of it you're feeding coons, which you're then going to go predate
And
on turkey eggs.
the statistic that really blew my mind, to get back to something I mentioned a second ago about how much corn is being put out there, South Carolina DNR did a survey of their hunters a few years ago. And if you extrapolate results from that survey, they ask a lot of questions about how much feed hunters are putting out. And if you extrapolate the results from that survey statewide, essentially what it boiled down to is hunters were putting out a bag of corn per square mile. So every 640 acres across the state was getting a bag of corn a week year
Wow.
round.
That's a lot of corn.
It's not hard for a coon to make a living
No. No.
with
And
those
then
kind of numbers.
so you're giving them that kind of feed. And if you go, I'll add to this, and I don't know how far you want to go, so you can stop me if you want to, Joe, but you go back to before feeding was so popularized, or baiting was so popularized for hunting. And you look at some of the original raccoon literature, and these were people that were actually studying raccoons when they were a popular game species, right? So they were trying to promote their population so coon hunters could chase them. And time after time, in a lot of these studies, during the fall and winter, corn shows up as one of their preferred food items, regardless of, whether or not people are putting it out there, they're finding it. So when you add all this corn that we're pouring out to the landscape, you're providing them with a preferred food resource. Even when baiting wasn't that popular, you just look at their food habits and you can see it. And you hear things from trappers all the time about, especially the ones that target raccoons, that they love trapping on baited properties because the population is so much higher there.
Yeah. Oh, I believe that for sure. No
You
doubt.
know, and then you couple that with the fact that our landscape is changing, so that particularly, and I know we were kind of focused on food plots and deer today, and I keep taking it back to turkeys. I can't help it. I'm sorry.
It's okay. I
But
forgive disease.
I already
Yeah, it
forgive you.
is.
It's a sickness. Y'all all know that. But the habitat is changing in a way that is no longer as beneficial to turkeys. It puts them at a disadvantage, and it puts the raccoon at an advantage, and then we're adding the corn to it, right?
Right.
So it's like, not only are we going to build you this nice little home, but we're going to serve you 3 square meals a day in it too.
Yeah. And by the
Right.
way,
Yeah.
while the turkeys come in and potentially you're feeding on the aflatoxin on the corn,
Well, that's a
like,
whole nother layer on top
right?
of it,
Like,
right? Yeah,
it's.
there's great data. There's great data out of Mississippi State that shows pretty much anytime it's warm and humid, the levels of aflatoxin in corn, particularly corn that's on the ground, is high enough to meet that toxic threshold for
Well,
turkeys.
good thing it doesn't get warm and humid at my place in Alabama.
Never.
Right. Yeah, we don't have that in Alabama.
Never. And you know, to speak to that a little bit further too, a lot of folks say, well, we're not finding dead turkeys all over the place, and in spite of the fact that there's corn everywhere. And that's true. I don't think it's necessarily killing them en masse, but you just think about it, it doesn't have to kill them. If it can just make them a little sick and slow them down a little bit, and then we've already talked about how the predator situation has changed, and if it makes them more susceptible to succumbing to that predator,
Right.
then you know it's still kind of inflaming the whole situation.
Yeah,
Yeah,
it's
you're
kind of
going
like
backwards.
with CWD. You know, they say a lot of the deer that end up dying from CWD, they die from predation. Like, they're not
Right.
just
Yeah.
keeling over and being found like they are when they die of EHD
Yeah.
in a pond or a stream or river somewhere. Like,
Exactly.
they're getting sick and some other animal's coming along and taking them down, and you know, you never know.
100%.
The
Yeah.
proof's in the pudding, though, right? Do we have more turkeys now or less turkeys now? Like, I mean,
Yeah.
compared to people that have hunted them for the last 30 years, like, I haven't talked to
Right.
anybody recently that says, like, yeah, it's the heyday. Like, I mean,
Yeah.
it's not
No.
bad everywhere, and there's certain
That's right.
properties. I mean, I had a real good season this past season. I'm not saying, again, not saying the sky's falling, but like, it's not good across the landscape if you're just looking at the
That's
big
right.
data.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, a lot of that landscape level population change is related to habitat, not necessarily predators, but predators, as I've mentioned, are a part of that equation, you know. And I feel like if we already know that the turkey populations are suffering, why wouldn't we want to do everything in our power to try to, you know, help with that, and especially not do anything to potentially make it worse. And in fact, I've got a student that's about to start trapping here in a couple of weeks on a project that is specifically designed to answer this question related to whether or not feeders are benefiting the survival and reproduction and of turkey nest predators, and whether or not that's translating into increases in turkey predator density. So I'll be interested to share those results with y'all in a couple of years, hopefully.
Well, that is why your podcast has become so popular, is because you guys get into the research and you get into the data, and it isn't just Joe's feelings on the subject or Will's feelings on the subject, based on, you know, cowboy logic. It is,
Yeah.
it y'all
Yeah.
really dive off
Science.
into the science of it. And it's one thing I appreciate about what you guys are doing, and it's why we wanted to talk to you know, about ryegrass today, because
Yeah.
there is a lot of science behind this. It isn't just, you know,
Yeah,
what Will
personal
wants to
feelings.
see growing, you know.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and
So
I mean, I guess to circle back to that, I mean, the way that I feel about turkeys right now, to kind of sum this all up, is they're already struggling for those open areas that grow the plants that they need to raise poults. Let's not plant something out there intentionally that's going to diminish the quality of those areas for turkeys.
yeah, kind of circling back before we close out on the food plot deal and the ryegrass thing. What's one
Yeah.
thing that you wish more people knew about food plots and their impact on the wildlife on your property?
Yeah, I love that one. The biggest thing I would say is a lot of hunters and land managers, they plant their food plots in the fall. You know, they go out there and they hunt over them, you know, a certain number of times during the hunting season. And then, especially if they're not turkey hunters, they don't go back and look at those food plots until the following fall. But there are what I would like to kind of impart on people is that there is some management that you could do. And Joe, you were talking about this, and this is kind of part of what led to you realizing that you had that ryegrass problem in some of your fields, is that we can manipulate those plantings, and particularly we can choose species to put in there that will allow those food plots to not just benefit deer nutrition, but to also provide some pretty good turkey brooding cover throughout the early summer. So yeah, food plot doesn't just have to attract deer in the fall and winter, but it can serve some important roles related to your habitat management goals during the summertime too, if you treat them the right way.
Well, Will, I know you guys have discussed that topic in detail
Yeah,
on your podcast. If folks
that's
want to
right.
check that out, how can they find you guys?
Yeah, so our podcast is Wild Turkey Science. I co-host that with Dr. Marcus Lashley from the University of Florida. We've got, I don't know, something like 110, 120 episodes up now. And if you just, type it into Google, you can pull up our whole catalog and pretty much anything that you could want to learn about habitat management. Not, I mean, it does have a turkey focus. We talk a lot about deer on there too. So food plots, burning, herbicide application, all that kind of stuff. Anything a land manager needs to know, there's probably an episode there for you.
Butch, as a landowner, I get a knot in my stomach when I find out I'm doing something wrong or when I see something on my property that I don't want to see. Like invasive Kogan grass. I ran across the first patch of that on my place and I was just like, dadgummit.
Dang it.
I mean, just like, gosh,
It's just constant.
it
It's
is.
constant. There's always going to be something to manage. I picked up a lot from Will. I really enjoyed this one. Some of the statistics that he was talking about, planting that big giant field in ryegrass, oats, and different stuff. The consumption rate on the ryegrass is something that really stuck out to me. I believe he said 10% or something incredibly, incredibly low.
They just don't like it as much.
They don't like it as much. Yeah, it grows quicker and it's cheap, but you're not doing the best thing for the property.
We're not even doing the best thing for yourself if the seed might be cheaper, but I believe the number he said was like wheat. Winter wheat was going to produce 6,000 pounds, whereas ryegrass is producing 5,000. So I mean, just right there. It might be a cheaper seed, but it produces less. So it's really not cheaper.
Yeah, and
No,
it's
I mean
less palatable, and
you
the deer
think
don't
it's
like it as
cheaper because
much.
it's got a lower price on it. Yeah, and then on top of that, the deer don't like it as much and it makes it hard for a turkey poult to, which it's already hard for a turkey poult. Everything wants to eat a
Right,
turkey poult,
right.
and yeah, I mean it's not anything I think to beat yourself up over if you're keeping your woods, in prescribed fire and you're keeping your plantation's thinned and you're doing what you can do in a bunch of other areas, this turkey's probably just go rear those poults somewhere else on your property, and if they got
Yeah.
that thick ryegrass on that plot. But the more
You
you
don't
know,
know.
the better decisions
That's
you can
exactly what
make,
I was about to say. You don't know what you don't know. So all you can do is educate yourself, listen to people that know what they're talking about, like Will, that have research to back up what they're saying. It's not just Will's, personal decisions or
Right.
feelings. Educate yourself and do what you can to do what's best for your property and your wildlife on your property.
Good, better, best. Never let it rest till the good is better and the better is best. There you
That's
go.
right.
Well, that's going to wrap it up for us this week. Appreciate you joining us. We want to make it easy for you to listen. So here's a handy option for you to get the podcast emailed to you each week. Just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. Again, just text the word hunting to 773-770-4377. You'll join our email list. And wherever you are listening to podcasts, go ahead, subscribe, rate, and review. Send us a written review. We'd love to hear from you. If you've got a show topic that you are interested in and like to see us cover, just email us at pros@landhunting.com. That's going to do it for us. Y'all stay safe out there. We'll talk to you next time.